Thank you, Gene. You know, there was supposed to be Doug Kamek on this panel, another natural law kook. They figured that would be a more even balance. Will the events of September 11 result in lessening our rights of privacy and other civil rights? Of course they will, and they should. As Judge Richard Posner has pointed out with his usual realism and bluntness, it is a mistake to think of, quote, existing civil liberties, freedom of the press, freedom of protection of privacy, rights of the criminal suspects, and the rest, as sacrosanct. Insisting that the battle against international terrorism accommodate itself to them. It stands to reason that our civil liberties will be curtailed. They should be curtailed to the extent that the benefit of greater security outweighs the cost in reduced liberty, unquote. Whether the gain in security from any measure outweighs the loss in civil liberties depends entirely, of course, on who is making the evaluation. The salient fact of American life today is a deep cultural divide between a liberal elite consisting of academics in elite institutions and their progeny in the media and other verbal professions. And on the other hand, the great majority of the American people. In the view of most people, historically, and surely also today, protection of personal security is the very highest value, the very point of government. In this, as in many other things in our society today, however, they are opposed by their educational, intellectual, economic benefits, the liberal cultural elite, who tend to value government efforts to protect personal security much more lightly, perhaps because they usually are better able to provide protection for themselves. Or perhaps it's just because liberalism requires a shaky connection to reality. The evaluations are reversed when it comes to the other side of the issue, limitations or infringements on personal liberties, such as freedom of speech or privacy. To those whose only tools and products are words, little is more important than freedom of speech, except, of course, when it's used to discuss racial preferences on campus. To the ordinary American, however, it probably appears that we have a lot more freedom of speech than we really need. Most Americans could do very well without, for example, the right to curse policemen, to parade vulgarities through courthouses, to have child pornography on the internet, all constitutional rights. Perhaps most important, most Americans accept the reality that terrorists could, for example, detonate a nuclear device in one of our cities, which answers Gene's question. Then what? Well, then what, most Americans would agree, anything that can be done to prevent that is worthwhile. The situation in regard to privacy, which is perhaps even more than freedom of speech, very much an elite value, something of which the ordinary person has less need than the elite, many academics, usually proportionally to how liberal they are, see their essential function as maintaining an adversarial, if not a subversive, relationship to American society, its traditions, mores, and beliefs. They have reason to believe, therefore, that the less society knows about what they are doing and planning to do, the better. They tend to have a lot to be private about. To the ordinary American, on the other hand, privacy is a much less pressing concern. He typically experiences less of it in his daily life, in his home, in his job, and being less accustomed to it, feels less in need of it. He probably has no serious objection, for example, to having a drug-sniffing dog walk around his car, or having a heat detecting device pointed at the sign of a building, or having a narcotics agent squeeze a package in a bus rack. Even though, as the Supreme Court has recently told us, all of these violate his constitutional rights because of the deleterious effect they would have on privacy. These new expansions, so-called rights of privacy, are extremely good news for those of you planning terrorist activities or entering the narcotics trade, but much less so for the rest of us. The lack of good arguments against the very moderate, indeed inadequate, steps taken by the Bush administration to combat terrorism, for example, the USA Patriot Act, is best indicated by the feebleness of the arguments that are actually made against it. The egregious Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, then chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for example, opposed the act on the ground that, quote, "we must not give up our liberties in improving our security," unquote, because, he said, delivering the standard punchline of empty arguments, quote, "if we do, the terrorists win," unquote. We give up our liberties, of course, with nearly every law, the purpose of law being to keep people from doing something they would otherwise do. The terrorists, it seems, have been winning for a long time. The ubiquitous Nadine Strossen of the ACLU, right? Have you ever heard of a conference where you didn't hear she was at? Not the ones I heard yesterday. Opposed the act because, she said, it infringes her right of privacy. Stripped of the mystification in which it is typically embedded, a right of privacy is simply a right to conceal information. The assertion of such a right obviously invites the question, what is it you wish to conceal? Nadine so dislikes this question, it reduces her to gibberish. She complains, well, quote, "well, what do you have to hide?" I'm always asked. "What I have to hide is my privacy," unquote. That is, what she has to hide is her right to hide. But she also wants to hide, she continued, quote, "my personal thoughts, my intimate conversations with friends, my political views, and it's just not the government's business," unquote. Well, I see no problem with Nadine hiding her personal thoughts and political views. In fact, I recommend it. But as to intimate conversations with friends, they're probably better carried on somewhere other than over the new electronic media to which the act applies, just as they were before these new media became available. Grover Norquist, tax reformer turned Islamicist, told Congress that the act may violate the Ninth Amendment, the ultimate proof of the emptiness of any argument. The Ninth Amendment is simply a negative. It says that listed rights should not be used to disparage others, which, of course, I've never seen anyone suggest it be used that way. It is completely void of any substantive content, which is why Randy Barnett has had to devote most of his life to writing books and making some up, which you will no doubt hear about. Richard Levy, a constitutionalist at the Libertarian Cato Institute, told Congress that he really does want to fight terrorism, as of course do all opponents of every effective means of fighting terrorism. But he found it necessary to warn Congress that, quote, against, quote, shredding the Constitution is not the way to do it, unquote. Fortunately, the Constitution does not shred as easily as he thinks, because for one thing, there's a lot less of it than he thinks. If anything is in danger from a serious and effective attempt to combat terrorism, it will not be the Constitution, but only some of the Supreme Court's more extravagant additions to it. The allegedly endangered liberties are always said to be constitutional rights and therefore sacrosanct and beyond the power of the majority to change, no matter how unwanted or harmful. Ignoring Justice Robert Jackson's famous admonition that, quote, the Constitution is not a suicide pact, unquote. It is important to recognize, therefore, that most of the claimed rights, and certainly the claimed right of privacy, come not from 1791 in the Bill of Rights, to say nothing of 1789 in the Constitution, but from nothing more ancient or venerable than the 1960s and the Warren Court and its successors. They are largely the result, indeed, of the utopian egalitarianism, distrust of democracy, and hubris of William J. Brennan, Jr., and his equally radical ally, William O. Douglas, America's Ayatollahs. Brennan and Douglas, usually joined by Black, Warren, and Goldberg, subscribed to the notion, popular in the 60s, that the criminal is a victim of society and society the criminal. It followed that every obstacle put in the path of effective enforcement of the criminal law was a step in the direction of equality and justice. And so we got Miranda rules, exclusionary rules, writ of habeas corpus vastly expanded so that a criminal could not have too many appeals. The objective, after all, was to convert the criminal trial into a game in which each side would have an equal chance to win. But since the defendant is almost always clearly guilty, if he is to have a chance to win, he must have many chances to escape, and the state as few chances, many obstacles to conviction as possible. This is the system of constitutional criminal procedure that our civil libertarians insist must not only be preserved, but extended even to the fight against terrorism. Overlooking, I think, that while permitting an ordinary murderer to go free may result in a few more murderers, freeing terrorists could have serious consequences. It is not difficult to find examples of how anti-terrorism law has been treated as a game. By applying to it the constitutional rules made up by the Supreme Court for our criminal law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA of 1978, provides for the electronic surveillance of suspected terrorists and spies in the United States. It was supposed to make warrants easier to obtain than under the general criminal law. In the mid-1970s, however, there was great concern to guarantee that intelligence surveillance be confined to foreign affairs. We wouldn't want a government, after all, that while looking for terrorists, happened to break up a mafia conspiracy or some kidnapping scheme that would infringe their privacy. In order to obtain an IFSA warrant, therefore, law enforcement officials must first obtain the approval of the Attorney General. Before being allowed to apply to the judge of the special FISI court, the chief judge in 2001 was one Royce Lamberth, given to reprimanding the FBI for excessive enthusiasm in seeking warrants. As a result, law enforcement officials came to believe that they had to be able to show that a suspect likely was a terrorist before they would be permitted to use electronic surveillance to find out. It is true, as privacy mavens complain, that applications to the court were almost always granted, but only because the agencies knew that it was useless to apply unless they could meet a high standard of proof. Situation is illustrated all too well and all too tragically by the case of Zacharias Massoui, a French Moroccan who was almost surely the fifth missing terrorist on one of the September 11 hijacked planes. A flight instructor became suspicious when Massoui was first evasive and then belligerent when asked to state his nationality. And when he sought to learn to navigate a commercial airliner, but had no interest in learning how to take off or land. Wasn't part of the plan that he had for it. The instructor alerted the FBI very specifically, quote, "Do you realize how serious this is? A 747 loaded with fuel could be used as a weapon," unquote. How's that for prescience? Massoui was found to be in the country in violation of his immigration status. He refused an FBI request to examine his laptop computer, leading them to conclude he had something to hide. The French intelligence service reported Massoud had, quote, a radical fundamentalist background. Can you believe that the Department of Justice lawyers refused the FBI's request to seek a warrant to examine Massoud's laptop? No doubt out of a fear of offending Judge Lambreth. The information received from French intelligence might be worthless, the lawyers pointed out, because who knows how many people there are in France named Zachariah Massoud. You can't be too careful in these matters. You could invade his privacy otherwise. Justice proposed instead to send Massoud to France and let the French examine his laptop. Only after 9/11, and the towers were down, did justice agree to seek a warrant. Are you grateful that American law protects your right of privacy to that extent? It's too bad, of course, that the 3,000 people killed at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon no longer also enjoy the right. The World Trade Center towers would almost surely be standing if airport security in Boston had been permitted to question and search the clearly suspect passengers who became hijackers. Because of their credit card use, payment, one-way trips, and so on, instead of being allowed to examine only their checked luggage. We have the consolation of knowing that there was no, quote, racial profiling, unquote, or infringement of privacy. To make sure their privacy is protected further, the ACLU wrote to each of the Arab embassies, advising them that it stood ready to assist them in evading government surveillance. The ACLU never learns. On a personal note, many years ago, my wife and I were just both out of law school, living in a first-floor apartment in Washington, a distinctly downscale neighborhood. Some policemen came running through the door, pounded on the door, and asked could they run through our apartment in pursuit of a burglar. I, of course, said, by all means, gentlemen, come in. I had no doubt then, as now, which side I was on. It would be, but what if while they were in there, they happened to take a peek in my closet? Well, that would be okay with me, too, because there was only my umbrella in my closet. I had no reason to be ambivalent as to which side I was on in the government's efforts to protect personal security. But national Muslim organizations, with the aid and encouragement of the ACLU, devote themselves to advising members they need not cooperate with government officials and should insist on strict enforcement of alleged rights of privacy. Which side do you think they're on? Which side was Hassan Akbar on, who dropped the grenade in the tent of his colleagues in the war, killing other soldiers in Iran? Is it a coincidence he was a black Muslim? He wasn't a Christian Scientist. In most systems, law enforcement officials take suspected wrongdoers to court. In the American system, terrorists who find surveillance annoying take law enforcement officials to court. Suspected terrorists can sue the CIA and the FBI agents individually for actions taken in the line of duty. Can you believe the CIA and FBI took the position that instead of defending their agents, the agents were required to defend themselves at their own expense? The agents were helpfully told that, after all, they could take out insurance. No doubt this did wonders to keep up their morale and guarantee their vigorous pursuit of terrorists. The National Commission on Terrorism, however, yes, there is such a body, though it does little good, had a helpful suggestion. It recommended that the CIA and the FBI pay for the insurance, not that they defend them. All right, finally, our government's security efforts under current law can probably be more accurately described not as a game, but as a farce. Surely only an enjoyer of farce would insist that the nation's intelligence operatives, that is, spies, seek as informers only persons of good moral character and not operate undercover as clergymen, reporters, or humanitarian workers. Wouldn't it be simpler to require the CIA operatives just wear a CIA t-shirt or beanie? We have been so rich and secure for so long, we could afford to be foolish and reckless. We could afford our Brennans and Douglases. We have suddenly been brought to realize, however, that we are no longer so secure. In fact, our very wealth and success have made us exceptionally vulnerable. A few dozen suicidal fanatics can convert our magnificent system of air transportation into an arsenal of deadly guided missiles, and our awe-inspiring skyscrapers into helpless targets. Once this realization sinks in, it will mean that we will have to leave the never-never land of today's constitutional law and take again seriously the first responsibility of government. Thank you.